On the Empire Podcast this week, we have Al Gore as the former Vice President of the United States of America pops in to talk about an inconvenient sequel. Plus, we have Al Gore as David Lowery talks about his thought-provoking latest, A Ghost Story. There's all that and the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that hopefully won't disappear in a nuclear inferno mid-sent. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, back from a week's gallivanting in France. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. Are we still here? Are we all still alive?
Yeah.
No one's, so hard to tell.
No one's blowing us up yet? We're good? All right.
Oh, don't say it yet. This doesn't go out for another day.
This is true. Fans of bits where I read out sponsorship blurb will be delighted to know that this week's episode is brought to you by Sky Atlantic, which brings you exclusive new big screen drama every month. And as if to prove it, their brand new revenge thriller, Tin Star, is coming to your TV very, very soon. All 10 episodes starring Tim Roth. You know, Tim Roth, out of Reservoir Dogs, The Hateful Eight, Pulp Fiction, and other movies not directed by Quentin Tarantino. And Christina Hendricks from Mad Men. They're in it. That's very exciting, isn't it? It's exciting. All 10 episodes are going to be available from the 7th of September. Mark it on your calendar. Tattoo it on your skin. 7th of September, exclusively on Sky Atlantic. But more on that coming up later in the podcast. Oh, yes. That is a promise, not a threat. This week, though, we'll get to that in a second. This week, I am joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. I don't know about tin stars, but they certainly deserve gold stars for attendance in the face of terrible gags about Supernatural. Black and white Russian movies about death. They are, of course, our geek queen, Helen O'Hara, who is wearing, and I shit you not, Supernatural socks. And by that I mean they're socks emblazoned with the television show Supernatural. They don't float in the air and produce ectoplasm. Or maybe
they do. Yes, I went to America last week and I happened to pass a Hot Topic and I went in to see what Hot Topic had.
Is that like a chocolate bar heated up to a... Because I would just melt.
It is a popular geek store.
Oh.
Yeah. And it turned out they had an entire display of Supernatural merch. And I decided not to get the eyeshadow palette, but instead to get some useful socks.
That's amazing.
So today I'm wearing my Team Dean socks.
Did you get the Sam and Dean shirt? No, you didn't. You know why? Because they never wear any.
There were loads of shirts. Most of them had no sleeves, but there were loads of them.
Are they sleeveless?
No, they're not. They're always wearing shirts, Chris. This is part of their appeal. I like plaid shirts, and they're always wearing plaid shirts.
So when they're not wearing shirts, which is always, all the time,
my understanding,
they're abs, big abs.
Look, there are abs there under the shirt, but you just have to use your imagination.
Okay. See why you like the show.
Well, this is a coincidence, because I literally ordered a sickle from the art house shop that sells art house stuff.
Amazing.
The Bergman corner of the art house shop.
Wow.
Yeah.
Bergman's your favourite superhero, isn't he?
Top Bergman.
Bergman. Certainly is.
Yeah?
Yeah. Give me 20 minutes, I'll think of another funny one.
Bergman's Warehouse. No?
Bergman's
Warehouse. Well, Men's Warehouse.
Top, no. Bergman?
I tried Top Bergman, didn't really work. No.
Okay. Anyway, should we get on with the show?
There's something to do with Svankmajer, I'm sure. I just can't think what it is.
I haven't had an intro.
I wasn't going to do an intro for either of you this week. That's because I thought Al Gore was in this very booth just 8 hours ago with talking to James Dyer. You're going to hear the interview very, very soon. Al Gore, I cannot stress enough, the former Vice President of the United States, a man who came within a hair's breadth of becoming actual president. Was in this booth. He wasn't lost. He was here on purpose talking about his new movie, An Inconvenient Sequel. And he'll be up later on. And it got me thinking, he is possibly the most important person we've had in this podcast. He is, isn't he? He's the most powerful person we've had in this podcast, right?
He is, yes.
Okay, he clicks his fingers and, you know, people just...
That's my understanding,
anyway. So it got me thinking, I was going to ask you guys a question, which is why I didn't give you a traditional... introduction. If I'd known Helen was wearing Supernatural socks, Phil, I would have concocted something hilarious about there being a story called Top Bergman or something, and how you're wearing like Werner Herzog boxers, and how they're cold and inhuman and
pitiless
unfeeling
pants.
Yeah, but I didn't know that, so I didn't have time. But I thought I was going to ask you guys, who's the most powerful person you've ever met?
Meryl Streep.
Genuinely, really?
The most powerful person I've ever met in terms of like traditional sorts of metrics of power.
Like, have you met like a prime minister? Have you met a president? Have you met a vice president? James has met a vice president now. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, but he's not vice president anymore, is he?
But you're always vice president, aren't you? They still call you vice president,
yeah,
Al Gore.
Like,
they still call you
it's
president
not like
Barack
you're
Obama.
You're still like stepping into the Oval Office.
You were president of the BABSOC, right? So they still call you that, right? When
obviously,
you go back to...
Because yeah. That very much is still a going concern.
When you go back to Oxbridge with Batgirl.
That is offensive.
You
that
know,
is offensive.
You're there. Which one were you, Oxford or Cambridge?
Oxford. Jesus.
Oxford. Okay.
Wouldn't be caught dead with those light blue motherfuckers.
They did
I'm kidding.
Lights. They did footlights.
Yeah, they do have the footlights, yeah.
What's Oxford University ever given the world of comedy?
The other half of Monty Python.
Yeah, good point.
Thank you.
But apart from... Okay. Have you ever met anyone like properly powerful? Like
properly
I met
powerful
when I was a proper journalist. I met David Trimble back when he was the First Minister of Northern Ireland, and
that's
pretty powerful.
Yeah,
that's pretty good. My wife, drinking game, has met several prime ministers in the course of her job.
Sure,
she also had in terms of real power. I'm sure I've said this in the podcast before, but she had the Spurs manager, former Spurs manager Andre Villas-Boas. In our car. He was in our car. She gave him a lift to the train station.
Can you imagine?
That's real power.
I wouldn't say he controls the levers of the state.
He can make defenses crumble with just a click of his fingers.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to think of some probably as soon as we finish recording, but I can't think of many now. I met the Spanish ambassador to Ireland once. You know?
No, that's terrible.
Well, hey.
Have you met the Taoiseach?
No.
Okay.
Although my mum went to school... with the former president.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool.
So we've met famous people, but they're like, you know, the real famous people.
Yeah, but some of them are very powerful and important people. I've been in a room with Steven Spielberg. You've probably met him.
I have,
powerful man.
Yeah.
Kevin Feige has been in, not this very booth, but our old very booth.
Our old very booth.
You know.
He's a powerful man.
Yeah. John Lasseter. We've met John Lasseter. Yeah.
Kevin Feige is so powerful, he gets other people to shake your hand. That's how powerful he is.
Is it?
Yeah.
It is, sure.
It's almost certainly what happens. Phil, have you met anyone famous?
And if it makes you as insufferable as it's made James today, then I'd like to keep it that way, if possible.
Has he been insufferable?
I mean, seriously.
It's really hard to tell.
He's been playing
on a scale of
insufferability. I need to meet Al Gore card pretty hard.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Pretty hard in the lead up and pretty hard afterwards,
I went to a book signing by Mikhail Gorbachev. But I didn't get to meet him because the line was too long and they cut it off. So that's a great story, I think. But I was in the area. I was in the vicinity of Al Gore. No, Al Gore. Mikhail Gorbachev.
Same thing? Wow.
I once chaperoned Jimmy Carr. He's powerful if you're into light entertainment.
Bring me the head of light entertainment. Okay, well, have a think about it. Anyone pops into your head? Anyone politically?
Yeah, I'm unlikely to have forgotten
Shirley
that
Bassey,
I met that
you
I
know,
once
really
met,
powerful people.
Like Helmut Kohl or someone. It's unlikely to have slipped my mind.
Mm.
So I think we can safely move on from that.
All right, okay.
Yeah, probably.
All right.
But we'll try and meet someone famous by next week.
Yeah.
All right, so that's a question from me. And obviously that backfired massively. Should we have a question from listeners?
Sure.
We should probably do that, shouldn't we? So here's a question that you guys really like. You insisted that we do it in this week's podcast. This is from @CHammondMovie. And he says, my bro-in-law created a game. Recast Heat with only British actors dead or alive. A simple. I mean, for the Sandra Bullock role, right away, you're going to go for Jodie Whittaker, right? For the Melissa McCarthy role. Oh,
wait,
heat.
No definite article there, Chris. Just Heat, not The Heat.
All right, okay.
Just so close.
Recast Heat with only British actors, dead or alive, and C. Hammond Movie has done it for us.
Sure.
To mock or to go, well done.
Sure.
All right, so Robert De Niro. In the role of Robert De Niro. hang on a second, I've forgotten their names. In role of Neil McCauley, Tom Hardy. Okay, Tom Hardy.
Right.
Al Pacino as Vincent Hanna. Michael F. Asbender.
Well, now there's one problem with that, isn't there? Not British.
He's not British. No, you're right. He's German Irish. Tom, what? It's true.
Yeah, no, it is. It just sounds weird.
Tom Sizemore in the unforgettable role of Tom Sizemore. Idris Elba. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Val Kilmer. I love this movie to bits, and I can't remember any of his character names. So please, God, what's Val Kilmer's character name?
Chris Chiharis.
Yes, thank you. Chris Chiharis will be played by Dan Stevens. John Foyt as a creepy fence man will be played
Nate.
By. Thank you. You've got it on the Googles. Okay, good. All right. So wherever I lack, you can fill in. All right.
Sure.
John Foyt as creepy Nate will be Mark Rylance. Danny Ooh. Trejo as.
Hang on.
Oh, it's Trejo. He plays Trejo. I'm pretty sure of it. I'm pretty sure he plays either a character called Danny or a character called Trejo.
He does. You're correct.
Jack O'Connell. Ashley Judd, as Chris Chiharis's wife, Charlene, will be Sienna Miller.
Right.
Diane Fenora, as Justine Hanna, wife of Vincent Hanna, will be played by Tilda Swinton. Amy Brenneman, who is... what's her name? The character
Edie,
the character Neil McCauley falls in love with, and then he walks away from her when he feels hate coming around the corner, and it's heartbreaking, and you go, no! She'll be played by Rebecca Hall. Natalie Portman will be played by Maisie Williams. And Bill Fichtner as Roger Van Sant will be played by Dominic Cooper. All right, so that's the cast list. I've got a couple of points. First one, where the hell is Wayne Grow? Wayne Grow is a hugely pivotal character in this movie. He is played, of course, in Heat by the actor Kevin Gage. So my suggestion would be that he is played by the former Aston Villa midfielder Kevin Gage in this movie. They're roughly the same age, roughly have the same level of menace, and one of them can deliver a great 40-yarder. So,
yep. No arguments here.
No arguments there. Wayne Grow, terrifying.
I mean,
Wayne
Grow. I'm a huge fan of his.
He may have played for Aston Villa.
Sure.
People are probably correcting me right now, but there is a former footballer. You must remember him, Phil.
Vaguely.
Kevin Gage.
It's quite a long time ago, but yeah, vaguely.
What if we populate the entire movie with aging
footballers?
Like Gary Mabbitt playing Vincent Hanna?
Well, I'll go make a coffee.
I'll go think about famous people I've met. All right, so how about it?
I was thinking you need a sort of an iconic pairing at the start at the heart of this. There should be a pair of people who worked together before, or who everybody wanted to work together before.
You're going to say Peg and Frost, aren't you?
I was going to say Judi Dench and Maggie Smith. Actually,
oh, you've done it.
I mean, they could even alternate roles.
Imagine
nightly.
The coffee shop scene. We're just sitting here like a couple of regular dames.
Because we are. That's not an impression of either of them. That was just dame voice.
I had this vision of, work with me here, Jim Broadbent and Michael Gambon.
Ooh,
wait.
That's a little bear.
Okay.
Costa Coffee.
Toddington Services on the M1. Just
marvellous.
Head to head.
And no, I think a Cornish tea shop.
Right.
And they should be talking over scones and tea.
All right, so it's Broadbent and who?
Gambon.
Gambon. Oh, he's Irish again.
This is true.
Come on.
This is true. Yeah, well, these are the rules. Only British actors, dead or alive. You know what? I'm gonna take out dead because it's really creepy.
Okay.
And also...
You get into Richard Burton and people like that.
Also, they're quite limited in terms of their acting ability once they're dead.
Once they're dead, that's fair.
I wouldn't do that. So you're going to keep it to Brits only. I would say that I have issues with Tom Hardy and Michael Fassbender as Hannah and Macaulay. They're far too young.
Yeah.
They're far too young.
Stuart McKellen.
Oh, my God.
Ooh.
Robert Carlyle and Ewan McGregor. Not entirely kidding.
Because she has a great ass. And you've got your head all the way up it.
I mean, I'm convinced.
Ferocious, aren't I? By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising.
Carry on.
Okay.
That's good. I like that. That's good. That's a good pairing.
Yeah.
Are they too old?
Yes, obviously.
Is this tough? You need people who are like in their 50s.
Well, that's why I said Carlyle and McGregor.
Carlyle and McGregor. Do you think McGregor's too... Is he too young?
Well, this is the problem that Danny Boyle had with doing a Trainspotting sequel. He's like, for years, they just looked too well-preserved. They looked exactly the same.
Yeah.
And that's why he kept putting off doing T2 until recently.
Right, yeah.
But now they're vaguely, slightly aging. They still look good, don't get me wrong, but, like, you know, they're looking more like men in their at least 40s now.
You've got to cast Ray Winston in this somewhere, haven't you?
Oh, yeah.
The Sizemore like, role, legally. Presumably.
No, he's got to be John Voight.
Or Danny Trejo.
Or
any of them.
Yeah.
Apart from maybe Amy Brenneman.
Yeah, he's not ideally suited for her, I guess.
Why is Big Driss being relegated to Thomas Sizemore role?
Yeah, that seems wrong.
Stick him up front.
Mm.
Kilmer.
Big Driss, right? As he would be an excellent...
De Niro. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Big
Liam.
Who do you put off...
Big Liam.
No, that's interesting.
Liam Cunningham. Remember he changed his name after he got married, so it's Liam Cunningham, Nee Son.
Okay.
And so Big Liam versus Big Driss. I predict big explosions. It should be a lot of fun. Those two round the coffee table. There wouldn't be room, quite frankly. You'd have to have a bigger table. You'd have to have a bigger Kate Mantellini's.
Okay, that could work.
Greg's.
That could work.
In Greg's.
Greg's.
So then who goes in the Kilmer role in that case? Is it Chiwetel Ejiofor? I think he'd be a good Kilmer in that one.
Kilmer again. Yeah, he'd be very good. I like that.
What about David Oyelowo? I have his name.
Yeah, I had his name down
as
well.
Has the Al Pacino role, though.
Interesting.
He doesn't. I don't think he has the... He's too reserved, David Oyelowo.
Yeah, that's probably true. He could do the Kilmer role, but I don't think he could do the Pacino role. For the Pacino role, you need somebody who can turn up to 12.
Yeah. Can Big Liam turn up to 12? I think he can. I think he can.
And we know he's good at phone acting, which is important for this as well. Mm. So
very good at phone acting. And Pacino in Heat never says goodbye. And I think Neeson could really do that. I think he could just hang up on you bastard, and then just put the phone down. There you go. All right, so are we going with that? We're going with that. We got Idris Elba as De Niro. We got, what's his name? Liam Neeson as Al Pacino. We've got Chiwetel Ejiofor as Tom Sizemore's character, who, of course, we all know Helen is called...
Hang on, I'm scrolling.
Gary.
Michael Cerito.
Michael, yes, of course. Who's going to play Jeremy Piven? And more to the point, who's going to play Jeremy Piven's original hairline?
Oh.
So the Val Kilmer, I like the casting of Dan Stevens. I think that's a good one.
Really? Okay.
Empire's former spirit animal,
Dan
Stevens.
I love him. I don't feel him for that character, but okay.
You don't feel him for that character? Why not? What's wrong?
I don't know. It's, yeah.
What are you going against the Steves?
I mean, nothing. I just, you know.
Okay.
Because of the restraining order. I mean, no.
John Voight, Mark Rylance. I'm not 100% convinced by that. I think it should be McKellen or Stewart or... McKellen and Stewart.
Alternating roles.
Alternating scenes. Yeah.
You know it makes sense.
It's the only way to go, quite frankly. Danny Trejo, played by Jack O'Connell. I think that's a small role to relegate Jack O'Connell. I think you give that to a young, up-and-coming actor who's just been released from prison. I think that's...
Presumably the prison thing is what made them think of Jack O'Connell. Because of Startup, not because he's spent a lot of time in prison personally.
No.
Just to be clear.
All right, fair enough. As your lawyer, I think we should stop this now. Ashley Judd, so probably the biggest female lead in the movie. And Sienna Miller, that's a fine
I've got her
piece
name
of casting.
Yeah, okay, that's why I've got her name written down.
Because it's been written down, for you.
How about Hayley Atwell?
Well, now, if you're just going to say names of people I like, then I'm all for it. Yeah, let's go for it. Okay, so Diane Fanora, Tilda Swinton. So she's meant to be playing Liam Neeson's wife. Do we buy that partnership? Do we buy that?
Actually had her down as a possible Pacino character.
Oh.
So I would
she'd
definitely
be good.
Not. Yeah, wouldn't she? So I wouldn't put her in a wife role, no.
Oh. What about Rebecca Hall?
She's too young. For Liam Neeson, she's like half his age.
Oh, Liam Neeson.
Yeah, this is Liam Neeson's wife, so...
Okay. Although, like, Liam Neeson's wife on screen is usually about half his age. But even so, Emma Thompson.
Emma Thompson. That's good.
That's good.
It's good,
isn't
it?
That is good. Obviously, they've got the Love Actually connection going on there as well. Yeah, I like that. That's good. Wayne Grow, let's forget about Kevin Gage, the former footballer. Let's go for it. Has to be. I can't believe this, that C. Hammond movie left off Wayne Grove on this list. That's a huge oversight.
Andy Serkis.
Andy Serkis is Wayne
Grove.
As everybody. Mm-hmm. Andy Serkis is Wayne Grove. Do we like that?
Have you seen?
Well,
have you seen
elephant?
Brighton? Have you seen not? Have you seen Brighton Rock? The remake. It was Rowan Joffe.
Rowan Joffe, who, of course, worked on Tin Star.
Oh, my word.
He's yes. the showrunner.
Tell me more about Tin Star, Chris.
Well, I will.
Let's interrupt
very,
us.
Very soon I'll be telling you more about Tin Star from Rowan Joffe.
Wait
so
long. How long
well,
have we
you're
to
Well, you're going to have to wait because we haven't finished this yet.
Okay.
Then we've got the Al Gore.
Right. Going back to Brian Rock.
Of course I've seen it because it's from Rowan Joffe. And
shut up, Chris.
Why would I not have seen it?
Andy Serkis plays a very, very good sort of spiv-like Cockney gangster. I think he could nail that role. Although Wayne Grove's more of a sort of neo-Nazi.
Wait, no, is this going to be like a British remake of Heat? I mean, or is this now set in like London instead of Los Angeles?
Well, like yes. Welcome to the Punch.
Because then,
yes.
if there
well,
was a Cockney originally, if he was a Cockney originally, maybe he should be not a Cockney now.
I think you give this role to Paddy Considine. He knocks out the park.
Yep.
Gets a BAFTA nomination.
Boom.
But cruelly loses out to Jim Broadbent for Paddington 2. No. Oh, I'm terribly sorry, Paddy. Oh, it's a little bear, he says. Natalie Portman, played by Maisie Williams, who I think is too old for this role. Do we know any young up-and-coming British actresses who might play that role?
We probably do, but we've forgotten them.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And William Fichtner, played by Dominic Cooper. That's decent. I can see there's a certain amount of sliminess that Dominic Cooper could bring to that role. I think that would work. People who are left off lists, obviously. There's no Hiddle Batch. There's no Cumberston. There's none of those great British actors. Are we annoyed about that? Do we think that, you know, Cumberbatch would be a good Bill Fichtner? He comes in, does 3 or 4 days' work.
Yeah, that would work. The way he did on Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Wait, we haven't fitted Mark Strong into this anywhere. What are we doing, people?
Well, okay, we've got to start again.
We've got to start over.
We've got to start again.
Look, leave this with us. We'll come back to it.
All right, so here's my idea. So the dogged cop is played by James McAvoy. The dogged criminal is played by Mark Strong.
Maybe it takes place
against the backdrop of Canary Wharf. No? Okay,
I feel like maybe that's been done.
Welcome
you know
to
they're
my
making
lunch.
The film about the Hatton Garden robbery.
I've pleaded and begged with them not to, but
they're
they
doing
are.
It.
Yes.
And it's got Jim Broadbent.
Oh, hello.
Michael Gambon, Michael Caine, Tom Courtney, Ray Winston. It's kind of this.
That's a good cast.
Yeah.
That's a good cast.
Yeah. It's kind of this. But older, but sort of blue rinsier.
Dude, any of those guys could still beat us up. Let's be respectful.
Oh, yeah. I don't think that's a case.
I don't think Jim
Broadbent maybe not all of them, but most of them.
I don't think Jim Broadbent's ever been able to beat anyone up. Do you know he was going to be Del Boy?
I think he could be.
He was going to be Del Boy.
Huh.
Yeah. And then he wasn't. Right, so that's that nailed. That's a good cast. I'd go and see that film.
Sure.
Yeah, you could shave 20 minutes off the running time as well. Be fine. What would we call it? London Heat.
Tepid.
Lukewarm.
If you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast, and why the hell would you not, you can do so via all kinds of methods, carrier pigeon, FedEx, usual ways. But you can find us on Twitter where we're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire podcast like C. Hammond Movie did. He also tweeted us directly, which sometimes helps. And you can also get in touch with us on Facebook where we're at Empire Magazine. And you can email us as well at podcast@empireonline.com. And hey, don't forget, in just over a month, September 16th, Saturday, September 16th, we're going to be live. Our next live Empire podcast is going to be coming to you from the London Podcast Festival in the prestigious... Well, I decided that it's prestigious. Saturday night slot. We're all very, very excited about that. We'd love to see you there. If you haven't already booked tickets, you can do so at
Brian Butterfield.
I love him so much he got his name wrong. Mm-hmm. www.kingsplace.com. co.uk. And if you book for three or more London Podfest events, because there are tons of podcasts that'll be doing live shows at the festival over the weekend, some really, really great ones, big ones, like My Dad Wrote a Porno, I think, are going to be there, that sort of thing. You can save 15% your ticket price. I checked today that there are two ticket prices. There's a £9.50 for members. That's gone. Those are all sold out. The only tickets that are left are £16.50. Now, I know that seems like a lot.
Oof.
That seems like a lot to see four idiots who don't know what they're talking about not know what they're talking about live. But believe me, it'll not be worth it.
That's,
please,
that's £4 per idiot.
That's four,
is that good value or not?
No, that's £4, 12 pence. 12 and a half
pounds,
pence.
It's
that's £4, 12 and a half pence per idiot.
Oh.
Plus, don't forget our super
Wait.
Special, stupendous star guest that I haven't locked down yet.
You
but I will.
Jim Broadbent.
It's me as Jim Broadbent.
Talking about Tin Star.
Oh, I love Tin Stars. You've got a little bear. Oh,
that's worth... How much is it?
That's the price is coming down. All the time. We will pay you £16.50. So anyway, come along, see the podcast, you know, and then it's a Saturday night. And then we'll all go out afterwards. We'll all go back to Phil's.
Yep.
And,
back to mine.
And get hammered. Hell,
as
you
is
in?
Our want.
All right, so there we go. The Empire Podcast Live, September 16th at the King's Place in London. Okay, time now for our first guest. He is not a filmmaker by trade, largely because he was too busy with his day job as, oh, I don't know, the vice president of the frickin' United States. But when he dipped his toe into the rapidly rising waters of filmmaking with An Inconvenient Truth a few years ago, Al Gore, for It Is He, set out to highlight and tackle the growing crisis of climate change on this here flat earth of ours. Now he's back with An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power, which picks up the story and shows how far we've come and how much farther we have to go before we're all turned into smoking fireballs, presumably. So here you go. Very excited about this. Can't actually believe this. This has brought a touch of much-needed class to the Empire Podcast. It is the man who was once the second most powerful human being on the planet. But enough about James Dyer, because he was talking to Al Gore. Enjoy.
Don't encourage him.
A very special guest today on the Empire Podcast. It is an Oscar-winning filmmaker, the former Vice President of the United States, the winner, I kid you not, of the Nobel Peace Prize, a man whose job is quite literally saving the world. It's Mr. Al Gore. Welcome, sir.
Good morning. Thank you. That Oscar went to Davis Guggenheim, the director of the first movie. I want to give him credit where it's due, but thank you. Good to be here.
Absolutely. Now, you gave us a wake-up call 11 years ago with An Inconvenient Truth, a rather stark warning about the dangers of global warming, and you're back now with An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. I went into this film, I guess, expecting a kind of slightly downbeat, you know, Mad Max is now a sort of documentary, you know, bleak vision of how we're all going to die, but it's actually quite an optimistic film in many ways. Mm. That was quite surprising. Did you think, when you made An Inconvenient Truth, that this is where we'd be at this point in time?
Well, I didn't know for sure. I had hoped we would make progress. And if you take an overview of the decade since the first movie, there are really two big changes in the last decade. The first is that the climate-related extreme weather events are unfortunately far more common and more destructive.
Yeah.
You just had yesterday a month's worth of rain in one day. In my country, the cities of New Orleans and Miami were flooded by these rain bombs last week. Every night on the TV news is like a nature hike through the Book of Revelation. But the second big change in the last decade has been that the solutions are here now. 10 years ago, they were visible on the horizon, but you had to have the technology experts assure you they'll eventually get here. But now they're here. And they're still coming down rapidly in cost, and we're beginning to make some real progress.
Where does the UK stand sort of among the countries that are doing things to combat this?
Well, it's a mixed bag. It looks as if the UK is going to be challenged to meet the commitments it's made under the Paris Agreement because some policy changes have been put off. I don't want to meddle in your politics here in the UK. We have our own hands full in the U.S., but The UK actually gets more electricity from wind than from coal now. And as the price of both wind and solar continues to drop, and as electric vehicles become much more affordable, and as other changes are introduced, I think our ability to solve this crisis is going to get better, and perhaps that will make it easier for the UK and other countries to meet the commitments.
What was interesting, I mean, you mentioned wind power in the UK. I think what your documentary does more than anything, I think, is educate people. And certainly I was very much under the impression, as I think a lot of people are, that in some way renewable energy sources were less efficient and perhaps not up to the task of taking over from traditional energy production. And obviously, according to the film, that's not the case at all.
It is not the case. It was the case, but luckily, solar and wind and other technologies have turned out to respond to both research and development and the scaling of production with much lower costs. Mm. The world gets more energy from the sun in 1 hour than the entire global economy uses for an entire year. So as we increase the fraction of that we can harvest and use productively, affordably, then the solutions are definitely now available.
Do you think that's in some ways the biggest battle? It's awareness, it's changing people's perceptions, because there seems to be so much disinformation about this, I think intentionally in a lot of places.
Yes, of course, the carbon polluters have used the same techniques pioneered by the tobacco companies years ago when the scientific consensus linking cigarettes to lung cancer and other diseases was disputed by those profiting from killing people with cigarettes. And they hired actors and dressed them up as doctors and put them in front of cameras to falsely reassure people that the science was wrong. And 100 million people died unnecessarily as a result. The carbon polluters have used the same approach, hired the same PR agents in many cases, and are performing in a very unethical, immoral way, and they've intentionally tried to inject false doubts to slow down the solutions. But a new participant in the debate has showed up, Mother Nature, and she's more persuasive than any of us. And people are connecting the dots on their own, and they're saying, let's get on with these solutions, particularly since they're becoming cheaper.
There's a wonderful quote in the film where you talk about our democracy has been hacked and about how we have to fix our democracy almost before we can fix this problem. I mean, how do you tackle that? I mean, certainly, from what I understand from television, so much of the budgets of people in the Senate, people in Congress, are paid for by these special interest groups, particularly whether it be big tobacco or big energy. So how do you separate that when there's such an obvious conflict of interest that doesn't serve a democratic process?
Yes, this has roots that go back a ways. When the democracy we love in the U.S. and the U.K. was formed, most of the communication was in newspapers. But television changed the terms of the discussion because in my country, at least, the politicians came to depend on raising huge amounts of money to run these television commercials. It's a bit different over here, but the same dynamic applies.
We have caps on spending, which I think are quite strict.
Yeah, and I wish we did in the U.S., but there are constitutional issues that we don't need to get into. But in any case, that's now changing. Because of, well, this program, for example, a podcast, there are no entry barriers. So you can speak directly to people. And last year in the presidential campaign, Bernie Sanders, regardless of whether you agreed with his agenda or not, he proved that it's now possible to run a very credible campaign without taking any money from lobbyists and special interests, but depending instead on small donations from individuals sent in over the internet. And I think that may be the future of politics. And if so, it gives us a chance to redeem the promise of a government of, by, and for the people.
Mm. I met with the filmmaker James Cameron recently. He's working on 4 Avatar sequels. He's become very sort of passionate about environmentalism and sustainable agriculture. Yeah. And he mentioned during the interview, and I think he said it a few times, that he believes the single biggest thing an individual can do to fight this is to adopt sort of an animal-free diet to go vegan. Is that something that you would agree with?
Well, In part. Basically, yes. But I don't proselytize on people's diets.
Because I know it isn't in the film. You don't really touch on that at all.
Well, I do actually, in the early parts of the film, mention that agriculture is a big part of this problem. It is about 15%. There are people out there who say it's half or more. That's not, according to the scientists, correct. It's about 15%, which is a huge number. And within agriculture, animal agriculture is a big part of the issue. I myself became a vegan 5 years ago, but I do respect the fact that people make their own choices about diet and people have different theories of what makes them feel healthy. There are compromises. Paul McCartney has pushed this Meatless Mondays program for a while now. It's a good place to start. And if you talk to your cardiologist, he or she will tell you that eating less meat is good for your health. I started becoming a vegan just to see what it was like for 30 days, but then I felt better, so I've continued it. It is one of the things that contributes to this crisis, animal agriculture.
So on an individual basis, because I mean, I think a lot of people say is, what can one person do? Does it really matter if I cycle my bike to work? And obviously, if everyone thought that way, nothing would ever get done. But on an individual basis, what do you think are the important things a person can do to help with this?
Well, first of all, learn about it. Knowledge is power, and it gives you the confidence to win the conversations on climate. And social revolutions are often won, first of all, in the conversations in a society, and only then will the laws change. And a good way to learn about it is by going to see this movie. It will be in 340 theaters for a special screening this Friday night. Tickets are still available. And then it will open broadly in the UK a week from Friday. But once you learn about it and you help to win the conversations, then use your vote and use your abilities as a citizen to influence the candidates and the office holders. Individual changes do matter, but as important as it is to change the light bulbs and windows, et cetera, it's more important to change the laws and the policies. We have a lot of good people trapped in bad systems, and when there is a carbon base for the entire energy system. And in the world as a whole, we still use carbon energy for 80% of all the world's energy. That's changing, fortunately. But we need to change the laws and policies. Nevertheless, it's non-trivial for individuals to be a part of the solution because it not only helps them reduce their impact, but it also sends a powerful signal to the businesses and industries that there's a growing market for changing the way we make things and generate energy.
It's funny. It often feels that environmental messaging seems to get lost in what politicians are campaigning on. I mean, it was interesting when the presidential primaries were coming up, the Republican field, I mean, none of their nominees seemed to have any kind of inclination towards this. And forgive me, I'm a film journalist, so it's slightly outside my field, but it feels sometimes like environmentalism becomes a partisan issue. What is it that kind of shifts the Republican Party away from tackling this issue?
Well, it's mainly their heavy reliance on money from oil companies and coal and gas companies and coal-burning utility companies. They've devoted an enormous amount of money to trying to bend the politicians to their will. And they've also financed some of these populist authoritarian political movements that frighten the politicians that they're going to face well-financed opponents who will do whatever the polluters want them to do.
Yeah.
But you know, there's a well-known law of physics that we all heard about in school that goes like this. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And what we've seen with the actions of Donald Trump is an enormous reaction with an upsurge of climate activism that's unprecedented. The people are speaking out, and they are taking control of this dialogue and this issue. And I'm very encouraged by that.
Mm. I mean, it's difficult with, I mean, Trump in particular, the fact that, I mean, didn't he tweeted that he thought climate change was invented by the Chinese to make American industry uncompetitive? It's like, that's not really helping the issue, is it?
Well, it's a distraction that makes it harder to solve the crisis. But I think people are seeing through that kind of nonsense.
Mm. Do you, I mean, obviously we don't want to draw into mud throwing about Trump, but I mean, when you see things like that and the fact that he appointed Scott Pruitt as head of the Environmental Protection Agency, there's a minute where you must think the world has gone mad.
Well, I've been at this for 40 years, so it's not the first setback I've encountered. And overall, there has been progress toward solutions. The Paris Agreement a year and a half ago was a truly historic breakthrough.
Yeah.
And even though Donald Trump said he wants to take the U.S. out of that agreement, he can't legally do so until the day after the next presidential election. And the governors of our largest states and hundreds of mayors and business leaders have stepped forward to say, we're still in the Paris Agreement. And it looks now as if the U.S. will meet its commitments regardless of Donald Trump.
Mm. And individual states seem to have taken it upon themselves to ignore him, which is
absolutely
helpful.
California, our largest state.
Yeah.
If it were a country, it would be the fifth largest economy in the world. New York State, also one of our largest. You combine New York and California, they would be the third largest economy. And there are many other states that have said, we're moving forward without Donald Trump.
Mm. Did you think?
And many cities, I'm sorry to interrupt you, many cities have now taken the initiative to switch over to 100% renewable energy. And one of them in the movie is the most conservative Republican city in Texas, as they describe themselves.
Yeah.
And in the heart of oil country, they have switched to 100% solar and wind. Their bills have gone down. Their air is cleaner. And it's kind of a side benefit that they're helping to save the future of humanity.
But still, and that was very impressive. You appeal to the bottom line and suddenly you get a lot more support.
Yeah, that money talks. It matters.
Absolutely. Now, you forgive me, we are obviously primarily a film publication and a TV publication. This has been unusually political for us, so I will steer it slightly back to our heartland briefly, if I may. I'm a long-standing fan of The West Wing, which was in no small part based on the administration you were a part of.
Yes.
And I know that they came up to Washington and met you. I just wondered what you thought of that show and also the fact that people seem to be now taking solace in that as a kind of alternate reality.
Yeah. Lots, yes. Well, I loved that show, of course. And it's interesting, isn't it, that there are so many dramas and comedies now based on the White House life. House of Cards is very dark, and Veep is very funny, and there are quite a number of others. But I think The West Wing really did capture the kind of dilemmas that people who are genuinely committed to trying to solve problems go through. I thought it was very well done.
Yeah. Tim Matheson obviously plays Vice President John Huynes in that, who's slightly antagonistic in there. How do you feel about the portrayal of the Vice President in the show?
Well, it's an interesting job, and I was privileged to have it for 8 years.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed politics, but I feel fortunate to have found ways to try to promote good changes outside of the political system.
You know, it's you can't get better, really, than saving the world. I think you've kind of, in terms of career progression, you've kind of peaked when that's your when that's your job.
Well, there are a lot of people who are out there doing good work, and I get inspired by the millions of climate activists at the grassroots level who are the real leaders of this movement.
Fantastic. Well, everyone go out and see An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power, which is out next week. Vice President Al Gore, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it a lot. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was it. That was Al Gore. Commercial begins. Because as you've already heard on the podcast, we have teamed up here, the Empire Podcast has teamed up with Sky Atlantic for this week's podcast. They're about to release their brand new thriller, Tin Star, with the binge watch guarantee, this guaranteed binge watch. All 10 episodes, 10, count them, 10, that's more than 9, less than 11, will be available at once on the 7th of September. They will also air weekly, if you can't handle your binge, they'll also air weekly on Sky Atlantic, which is your Monday evening, every Monday evening, for the next 10 weeks, sorted. And if you don't know what you can expect from Tin Star, it's a Sky original drama set in the beautiful landscapes of the Rocky Mountains in Canada. Tim Roth plays the main character, Jim Worth. He is an expat cop. He comes to the town of Little Big Bear as the new sheriff, ready to clean up the town, and he is targeted by a gang who plan on assassinating him. But their attempts fail, and they accidentally shoot and murder someone very close to Jim. And Tin Star then explores and follows Jim as he deals with guilt and obsessing on uncovering who's responsible and ultimately taking revenge. So it's a story full of vengeance. It's got crime. It's got conspiracy theories. Is Jim's violent past as an undercover cop in Britain catching up with him? Who hired the assassins to take him down? What's the local oil company run by Christina Hendricks got to do with it? What's love got to do with it? Behind the series, of course, as we discussed, none other than Rowan Joffe, who's best known for writing 28 Weeks Later, The American, directed the Brighton Rock remake that I deeply love. And he's put together an incredible ensemble cast, led, of course, by Tim Roth as Jim and Mad Men's Christina Hendricks. So once again, all 10 episodes available from 7th of September, only, of course, on Sky Atlantic. You're going to be hearing more about Tin Star in the coming weeks. We'll be exploring the series in depth over the next few weeks in the podcast. For an example, next week, we'll be hearing this person.
Hello.
Talking about her experiences on set. Helen, what can we expect? Give us a little test. Just a little teaser of what we can expect from your behind-the-scenes experiences on Tin Star.
There was a building and it was on fire.
Oh, my God.
Come on.
There we go. It's exciting, isn't it?
It is.
It's exciting. So more Tin Star coming next week from Helen.
Promotional activities.
I'm excited about it. I listen to other podcasts and I get excited about how excited people get about the promotional activities. And I thought, it's been a while since someone sponsored the podcast. And if it ever happened again, I wanted to get as excited as those people get excited.
And also, if somebody keeps sponsoring us, then they'll probably stop threatening to, make us actually do work instead.
Yeah. So
this is all good stuff then.
We welcome people on the podcast.
Remember Mr. Plough? When Homer Simpson advertises Mr. Plough. That name again, it's Mr. Plough.
Oh, yeah.
Just a faint sort of sense memory of that. But I loved it.
So weird.
I loved the enthusiasm. I can't wait to see the show.
Are you doing Danny Boyle?
I love it.
Danny Boyle.
I love stars. I love mountains.
If there's one thing I absolutely love, it's tins and stars. Great.
I don't mind your Danny Boyle impression when it's outside of my own immediate personal space. But when it's somewhere near my epidermis, I'm somewhat more uncomfortable.
Okay, well, that's it. The commercial has ended. The regular Emperor podcast has resumed. Okay, here we go. Straight into movie news.
Yes. What a week it's been. Well, it hasn't really. There hasn't been that much news, has there? I mean, I've been away.
I spent
the week halfway up a mountain, so I'm a bit hazy. But I do know that the Coen brothers, their Western TV series, is indeed, as pretty much everybody predicted, including us, going to Netflix. And they announced it with the following four iconic words. We are streaming, motherfuckers. God
amazing.
Bless them all.
Was there a comma there, or are they streaming motherfuckers?
There is a comma. We are streaming, motherfuckers! Exclamation mark.
Okay, the show is not called Motherfuckers, and they're not streaming it, or they don't have access to motherfuckers, and they're streaming them.
I mean, not that I know of. But that's their business. I don't want to know.
Do you think we've earned the explicit tag on this week's podcast?
I think we have.
I think we have.
It's actually, of course, called The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is a none more Coen brothers name. I think we can all agree. And it's going to be a miniseries that will intertwine six different storylines. So hoorah for everything, frankly.
That's interesting. That is very interesting. It's not the only interesting Netflix-related piece of news this week, of course, as you know.
It wasn't?
No, it wasn't. Did you miss this when you were up in the... Where were you this week?
I went to Yosemite.
Weird. Yosemite, okay.
And Santa Cruz.
What were you doing there?
I was exploring and hiking.
Is it true you met Joanna Robinson this week?
I did, of Vanity Fair fame, mm-hmm. and she is on several podcasts, including A Storm of Spoilers, mm-hmm. Discussing Game of Thrones, and we have been Twitter friends for a long time. We finally met IRL.
I thought I felt a great disturbance in the force.
That was it.
That's amazing.
So she was awesome. Hello, Joe.
Good. Good. I'm glad you're making new friends, Helen.
Thank you. Well, that makes three.
So, news this week that Disney are going to end their distribution deal with Netflix.
Yeah.
And they're going to launch their own streaming service with a targeted date of 2019.
This is bad news, though, right?
You think this is bad news?
Yeah, because the more that streaming services fracture, the more of them you bloody have to get to be sure of seeing things. And it does my nut in a little bit. You know, how many of these do we actually need? You know, you've got Netflix, you've got your Amazon Prime, you've got your Freeview or your
Apple
whatever.
Apple will be doing it soon.
Apple TV, yeah. You know, I just...
Well,
it's exhausting.
The scuttlebutt, of course, is that this is going to... And obviously Disney have the back catalogue to do this. They can
guys,
we've got obviously all our own stuff. We've got the Money Pit, I think, is a Disney film. Everyone wants to see that. They've got Marvel? Is that something we ever talk about?
I don't think we've ever discussed that.
Pixar, is that something that's...
Nah, it's not relevant.
No.
I certainly wasn't there last week.
They've got some cool stuff coming up in their back catalogue as well. So they can go, they can split away. Of course, the intriguing thing is the scuttlebutt seems to be that this is the start of mainly all the studios launching their own streaming services. And now, if they all do that, plus, as you say, you have Netflix, you have your one-off payment through Amazon Prime for Amazon Video, it's going to get pretty expensive to be a movie fan, I would say, over the next few years, if, of course, you wanted to do it. So, say, Disney, Sony, Warner Brothers, Paramount, Universal, Lionsgate, Studio Canal, Independence... that's eight alone, plus Netflix, plus Amazon Prime, plus if Apple start doing something as well.
If Hulu come here, I mean,
Hulu come here.
What about if somebody creates a place you can go and rent the things just for a small fee? And you can.
I feel like this is when Uber started, basically invented the bus. Did you see that story? Where they suggested that for certain high use areas, they might have larger capacity vehicles that would travel around on a schedule and pick up many people at once.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, wow, innovation.
You do feel like you're lurching into onion territory a little bit with this. If everyone has their own, it sort of defeats the entire point of, you know, a sort of a one-stop
central
shop.
Hub, a Netflix, for example.
Yeah, I already feel that now.
This is the thing about Netflix. I mean, and I love your idea, Phil. It's a real blockbuster of an idea, but I don't know whether it would, you know, gain traction. But the thing about Netflix, this is maybe why they are ramping up their original programming, their original content.
Yeah.
I mean, this week they announced that they're bringing David Letterman back on the small screen as well, which is hugely exciting. He's going to be doing six bespoke one-hour chat show / lifestyle things, and you know, obviously the man is richer than God, so he doesn't have to do anything he doesn't want to do. So
yeah.
I'm really excited about that. Amazon are delving into, I think, sports as well. That recently they've won the rights, I think, to screen. I think it's the Australian Open. I think it's going to be on Amazon. Correct me if I'm wrong, which I frequently am. But it's intriguing. I was at a Netflix thing a year and a half ago, and I spoke to Ted Sarandos and Reed Hastings, Reed Hastings is the CEO of Netflix, and Ted Sarandos is the chief operating officer,
officer,
I think. He's a content officer of Netflix. He's the guy who basically works with all the people, all the filmmakers and talent. And he said that, you know, I asked, will they ever allow download? No, they won't. And they said, well, okay. And they did soon after. I also said, will you ever see a day when you go into sports and when you start doing, and you know, chat shows and quiz shows and just start presenting regular programming? And they said, no. But I wonder if the landscape is shifting slightly and whether they may need to up not just films but TV and all sorts of other original programming.
Get
to
into
try
original sports.
Yeah, get
original, make
yeah.
up sports.
Quidditch. Why not? They've got the money to
there
to
is a
make
Quidditch,
it work.
International Quidditch League.
Why not?
So, that's just people running around, isn't it?
Well, it is, but that's funnier.
Ted Sarandos can make people fly. I've seen it. I've seen it happen. It's amazing.
Is that what happened to you when you were speaking to him? He just flung you across the room.
Pretty much with
airborne.
His mighty mind powers.
Then
he had his minions shake my hand
guess
for him.
Away.
And then off he went into the night.
It does feel like it's an evolving entity, Netflix, for one thing. Like, things are changing. They're starting to cancel shows.
Imagine being a Netflix show that got cancelled. You feel like the last person that's not got picked for the football team.
It's not good,
I mean, come on. How did they not get a second series? Well, come on. You give everything a second series.
Did
not
you watch Bloodline?
I got a second series. I got a third series.
I know, it did. But then it ended, and that seemed like a reasonable place for it to end.
Well, it hasn't ended yet.
It's ending.
I know.
Trust me.
Have you been to the future, Phil?
Yes.
Helen's been to Yosemite. I've been to France. Have you been to the future?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
Have you ever been to you?
I don't know. We'll see. I mean, the the worry from a Netflix point of view is that obviously it's carved a bit of a reputation as being somewhere that filmmakers can go and do risky things, you know, make a series knowing there'll be a second series and just throw shit against the wall and see what sticks. But that may change. And if it does, then maybe they'll start to lose a bit of their USP. But certainly losing the whole Disney back catalogue.
Yeah.
I don't really know how it works across Netflix and Amazon Prime and the other streaming sites at the moment. Are there Disney?
No, Amazon Prime at the moment. I mean, this is the only UK. I mean, obviously, our experience is confined to the UK, so I don't know how this works in the States. But Amazon Prime clearly have some sort of deal with Warner. So if you go on Amazon Prime, there's loads and loads of Warner Brothers movies, and there's constantly streaming. There's some really interesting stuff. Very few films. In fact, I don't think any films really cross across the two services. So already you kind of feel that you have, and there's Sky as well, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sky, you know, which I have as well, and they all have different things, and they all have different TV shows and
like Tin Star.
So you know, it's going to be interesting to see. Is there a breaking point?
What are they going to call it, Disney? Just quickly,
I imagine they're going to call it Disney.
Come on, they've got to be some form of
Disney streaming,
Pluto Vision or something. It's got to be.
It's not a Mickey Mouse operation, Phil. These guys will. Oh, these guys will put a lot of thought into this.
More than we have.
But I wonder if Disney are in the acquisitions business, if they're looking for, I don't know, a podcast.
I'm sure if they are, they probably won't buy us.
Why?
Have you listened to this one?
No.
I don't want to. I don't want to.
Okay.
Hey, so there was also news this week.
Yeah.
Is it Jim Broadbent related by chance?
God, no. Let's keep away from that. How about the fact that Deadpool director Tim Miller is on to direct, apparently, Neuromancer.
Thank God you're here.
Yeah, the William Gibson novel, the cyberpunk, the original cyberpunk sort of blockbuster, if you will. I'll be honest, I've read it because everyone's like, oh my God, it's the original cyberpunk blockbuster.
Yeah.
And I was a bit like, eh.
Okay, this is good because the reason I said thank God you're here, apart from obviously, just I'm glad to see you, Helen.
Thanks.
I'm glad
to see Chris. You. Yeah. Didn't get bitten by a rattlesnake or a grizzly bear. Winning.
It is. It's winning. Is that I thought you might have read that book, which I haven't.
I have, but it didn't particularly stick in my head. It's about a junkie and a hacker called Case who has his nervous system sabotaged and can't get into cyberspace and is offered a cure by very dodgy types. But he has to go on a secret mission in order to get the cure. So there's really cool ideas in it. William Gibson always makes me think a little bit of Philip K. Dick in that they have all of these amazing ideas, but sometimes the story that is actually attached to them isn't that brilliant. And for me, anyway, that was my impression of Neuromancer. But I'm sure, as with Philip K. Dick, the raw material is there for somebody to make a great film out of it. And it's been talked about on and off for years and years and years. So it'd be nice if it actually finally happened because it could look super cool.
Okay. That's interesting. Very, very good. Riz Ahmed is apparently in talks to star in Venom.
Yes, as a beloved Marvel character. Is that it? Who?
No one knows.
I mean,
presumably Riz Ahmed knows.
Well, I mean, yeah, but one would hope otherwise, you know, the talks would be really kind of vague and formless.
I wonder
if
it might be J. Jonah Jameson.
Huh?
That would seem like spectacularly weird casting to me.
What?
I mean,
why? Explain yourself.
What was the phrasing? The Marvel character? The
popular
phrasing?
Marvel Comics character.
Popular Marvel Comics character. All right, it's not.
They're all popular, aren't they?
But obviously, there hasn't been, in this reboot of Spider-Man, in this new iteration of Spider-Man, there hasn't been a Daily Bugle. There hasn't
that
been a JJJ. It's tricky to kind of have that ye olde newspaper editor operating in this world, in this day and age. And so I think they might want to jazz it up a little bit the way they have done with Aunt May and whatnot. And what better way to do that than maybe reimagine JJJ and the Daily Bugle as some sort of cutting-edge HuffPo blog type deal.
Sorry, cutting-edge HuffPo.
I know. Cutting-edge CompuServe.
GeoCities.
Let me just fire up a dial-up.
Say hello to the new CEO of Alta Vista.
What's the other one, the BuzzFeed people? Them.
BuzzFeed.
Like BuzzFeed. Yeah, they could... do you think they might be in the market to acquire a podcast?
I'm sorry, you've broken me.
Do you know what would make a good JJJ?
Who's that?
Jim Broadbent.
No.
He'd be brilliant. He'd be great. He'd be
good. Oh, hello. It's a little spider. Whoa. He'd say.
There is a reason that the last one we had was J.K. Simmons, is because when you get it right, you don't mess with it. Just hire J.K. Simmons and let us all rest.
Okay. I think it might be JJJ. I'm just... And also because Eddie Brock, who is Venom, his story is famously a photographer who gets jealous of Peter Parker. And so there might be...
But how can you have that story when you haven't had Peter selling any photos yet? You've got to change the story. It doesn't make sense, Chris. It doesn't make sense.
Oh, he might be Cletus Cassidy. He might be Carnage.
What? No.
The worst character in the world.
What? No. Oh, I don't understand Venom at the best of times, and this isn't helping.
It might be that.
Hey.
Anyway.
Mila Jovovich.
Oh, I was going to say that's true. Okay.
Oh, you go ahead then.
Okay. Mila Jovovich.
Tell me more.
There's more? That was the beginning and end of it for me. Well, she's going to be in Neil Marshall's Hellboy, Rise of the Blood Queen.
Who will she be playing?
She'll be playing Hellboy. No, the other one. She'll be playing the Blood Queen. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, David Harbour, of course, is playing Hellboy.
I have to say, I was watching her latest Resident Evil on the plane, and it was a lot of fun.
Yes.
There you go.
Genuinely, you thought it was a lot of fun.
Genuinely, because they never stopped having fight scenes in order to do any talking or exposition. So that was actually quite fun.
Yeah.
They just, one fight scene after another. Oh, look, it's a fight scene. Oh, it's another fight scene. And there were two Ian Glens, which is always kind of fun. So
it's true, there are two Ian Glens.
I was amused.
Yeah.
What's the film called?
Resident Evil :
Come on. : Exclamation mark.
Is Endgame. Is it Endgame? Not end. Finish.
You watched the last one. The very last one.
Yeah.
You watched you saw
the most recent one.
The final chapter of the series.
The final chapter.
The final chapter. Is it really called The Final Chapter?
I mean, I don't know. He had to prompt me.
Wasn't one of the Saw movies The Final Chapter?
Maybe.
Come on.
Was it Freddy or Jason a final chapter too?
Can anyone name all six Resident Evil movies?
No. Not in order. There was an apocalypse. There was a
umbrella scenario.
I have seen them all.
There was an extinction.
Oh, there was. Was there something beginning with Retribution?
Retribution.
Hey.
And an afterlife.
Afterlife.
Now put those together in order.
Was there a Requiem?
No. Should have been
a Requiem.
There should have been.
Yeah,
but have a Requiem.
Somewhere
but,
in there.
That's it. Resident Evil, the final chapter. It gets the Helen thumbs up. And the last thing before we do a shameless plug about this new issue of Empire. I thought this was quite interesting. The Cowboy Ninja Viking, which is an Image comic book adaptation which stars Chris Pratt as a new kind of assassin who manifests the toughest skills of three different personas, cowboy, ninja, and Viking.
Right.
Has a release date of June 28th, 2019. This is, of course, nuclear Armageddon permitting. June 28th, 2019. What's interesting about this is that it has a release date, but it doesn't have a director. Now, that would seem to be the wrong way around.
Yeah.
Surely. And I know this is the way they do things these days, and blah, 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 but most release dates are put into place for established properties, and people would go, oh, yeah, okay, I'll go see that movie in 4 years' time because I like Justice League or whatever. Cowboy Ninja Viking, I don't know.
I mean, people like cowboys and ninjas and Vikings.
But people liked cowboys and they liked aliens, and look what happened there.
That's true.
I like Residents and I love Evil. didn't
doesn't help you remember what order the films came in.
I love final chapters.
Okay.
I love Residents.
Yeah.
They're my favorite type of people who live in that block of things. Okay. So I just think this is interesting and it's good. It's going head to head with the sixth Transformers film, which apparently is going to be called Transformers and then just a big question mark going, And then Optimus Prime
I thought that was the name of this one, because that's certainly the way I felt coming out of it.
I think it's the way everyone felt coming out of it, going into it, during it, everything. But, yeah.
Just want to say, what kind of podcast would we be if we didn't at least mention the fact that the new Robert Redford Jane Fonda movie has got a trailer out this week?
Yes, this is great news.
Chief Hill, where are you going with this?
I don't know.
What's the name of the film, Phil?
It's called... It's called...
we had Al Gore in this podcast, not more than... Looks about what?
It's called...
45 minutes ago.
I don't know how to say it without it being stupid.
No, it's try.
Called...
How do you know the name
our
of this?
Our Souls at Night. That's Our Souls at Night.
So Robert Redford and Jane Fonda are in a film called Arseholes at Night.
Our Souls.
Our Souls.
No, our as in belonging to us.
Our.
And then souls as in ethereal.
Yeah, but the thing is, everyone
thing.
Pronounces okay. the word our as R, don't they? So yeah. going to sound
yeah,
like arseholes. So
I know, but
why?
Americans don't understand what that means. Because like, they always leave out the R, you see, so they don't understand. So nobody's obviously
somebody
picked
must
up
have
on
told
it.
It was just too polite to tell them.
This is based on a book, so at some point the novelist went, you know, oh, what a great title. What's it called? Our Souls at Night. It's like, dude. That's, you're really going to limit your market here if yeah. you're going for that sort of audience. No, no, no. Our Souls at Night. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's gonna play a huge. I'm definitely. I mean, lots of people are going to be downloading this by mistake.
I guess, like, that seems to work for Chuck Tingle. So maybe, you know, maybe it's just that's their métier. I don't know. Hey, so anyway, but Robert Redford and Jane Fonda, we love them both. And
yes, we do.
We wish it well.
We do, yeah. We totally do.
Arseholes at Night, everybody. Arseholes at Night. So, new issue of Empire is out, and it's massively exciting. I'm excited.
Yeah.
Hulk is on the cover.
Oh. No,
because he stars in Hulk Ragnarok.
No, Thor is on the cover because he stars in Thor Ragnarok.
Oh.
Wait, that's a different cover to me.
What?
Two
oh,
covers,
it's not called
people.
Hulk Ragnarok. It's Thor Ragnarok. So Hulk hasn't got his own movie yet. Okay. He's in this movie, Thor Ragnarok, which is the third in the well-loved Ragnarok trilogy. And
no.
Chris Hemsworth, Mark Ruffalo, Taika Waititi, Jeff Goldblum, all those people... Everyone loves him. Really looking forward to this movie. And Dan Jolin, the bastard, was on set in Australia.
Jammy git.
Think of the air miles, Ellen. Think of the air miles. And but also the great people he got to see and hang out with. So he has written this feature and is feza good. So do check that out. That's our main cover feature. Lots of world-beating access to... what could be the final Thor movie, or at least the final Thor movie with Chris Hemsworth in the title role. So it's very, very exciting. But there's more. There's more. It's a laden. It's an issue laden with goodies. So we have our Comic-Con special. We went out to Comic-Con a couple of weeks ago, and we had our own little studio there, as people may have seen the Facebook Live stuff that I did from our little studio at a major hotel. Nearly said what it was. And now you can see all the photo shoots and all the interviews that we did with people like Will Smith and Colin Firth and Taron Egerton and Peter Capaldi and the cast of Star Trek Discovery and Elijah Wood and Peter Serafinovich and so on and so on and so on and Ben Mendelsohn. Loads and loads of great people. That's in there as well. The Empire interview, James Dyer, the second most important person on the planet, travelled to LA to meet the most important person on the planet, James Cameron, as he's about to embark upon directing, in fact, I think he is right now, 4 Avatar sequels.
That's happening right now. Awesome.
And it's all very, very exciting. But he's also talking about Terminator 2, Judgment Day, the 3D version, which comes out at the end of the month. So that's all very, very cool. James got to talk to him for a long, long time. And that's great. We also were on set of It, which is awesome. And we have a feature written by Francis Lee, the director of a British film called God's Own Country, which is... fantastic by all accounts, and we have that there as well. We also have stuff from the first looks at Ready Player One, David Fincher's Mindhunter, which sadly is not a prequel to Mindhunters, Borg versus McEnroe, Resistance is Futile. We have reviews of all the big new movies, and in the section at the back of the magazine, which, you know, who cares about that really? I mean,
oh, it's the worst. And the guy
the
who
worst
edits
section.
It. Oh, he's the worst.
Yeah, the guy edits his.
What? Hold on.
Absolute arsehole at night.
No, the back section, Phil.
You're talking about the back section?
Yeah.
Yeah, couldn't agree more.
Yeah, terrible, terrible. So we got the Emperor Fume Guide is Life. Oh, Life.
Life.
Brian Cranston talks about his greatest roles. Ben Wheatley talks us through Free Fire shot by shot, and I mean shot by shot. He talks us through all the key bullets. David Baddiel writes this month's First Take Club, which was delightful. which is really, really cool. First Take Club, if you don't know what it is, if you haven't read the magazine for a while, hopefully we might put these online at some point. But First Take Club is shamelessly ripped off from the Ram Album Club. And it is, we get people to see a film that they haven't seen before and write about it. It's that simple. And this month we have David Baddiel. Yes, David Baddiel writing about Tokyo Story. So it's all very, very cool. Just £4.70 on sale now. September 2017 issue of Empire Magazine on sale now. All good and evil news agents on here and Asgard. Do pick up a copy. Let us know which cover you chose. Did you choose Thor? Did you choose Hulk? Or did you get the subscriber's cover?
Which is super cool, and which Taika Waititi coloured in himself with his own two hands and put on Twitter.
Indeed. It's all very, very cool. Right. Plug ends. Time for second guest. Our second guest this week is one of America's most intriguing directors. He was last on the podcast a few years ago with Ain't Them Body Saints, where he worked with Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara, and he liked the experience so much that he wanted to work with them again, only this time with one of them wearing a sheet over their head. That's roughly the premise of a ghost story in which Affleck's ghost haunts his house for what could be eternity. I spoke to Lowry earlier this year when he came to London about a great many things, from pies to Pete's dragon, and the pros and cons of getting an Oscar-winning actor to wear a sheet over his head for pretty much an entire movie. That's the stuff you're going to hear. The thing you're not going to hear, I hope, is the coughing fit that I had that derailed the interview for a good 3 minutes and features a lot of coughing, a lot of apologising for me, and David Lowry just sitting there watching this unfold and kind of going, what's happening here? I could make it to the door, but I think I might not make it quickly enough. I'm still recovering, and I'm going to hold that back from you guys. So here it is. Enjoy this interview with David Lowry.
We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the writer and director of A Ghost Story, David Lowry. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here. I have to say, David, you are something of a dark horse, because I don't even remember, but the last time I spoke to you, we were on Skype for Pete's Dragon. You were scoring it in Abbey Road.
Yeah.
And I asked you what you were doing next, and you said you were doing Old Men and the Gun with Robert Redford.
Yep.
At no point did this movie come up in conversation. At what point did the ghost story happen for you?
It was definitely underway at that point, but okay. I wasn't talking about it.
Okay.
Because I wasn't sure if it would work. So I didn't want anyone to be able to hold me to it later on down the road if I buried it. But it was definitely in the works at that point. And I think as soon as I got back from London, I flew to Dallas to do some test shoots and then back to LA to finish doing the sound mix.
Wow.
The entire process of finishing Pete's Dragon consisted of me, you know, working in LA during the week and then often flying back to Texas on the weekends to sort of put the pieces in motion for A Ghost Story so that we'd be able to start shooting it in June as soon as Pete's Dragon was done.
Okay.
And indeed, we started shooting it 2 days after we finished on June 12th, so almost exactly a year ago. And at that point, Old Man the Gun was supposed to shoot in September or October. So I was operating under the assumption that I had a very limited window in which to make A Ghost Story. But as these things do, that movie pushed all the way up until earlier this year. Mm-hmm. And I would have had plenty of time to do prep on this movie in a traditional fashion. But it's probably a good thing that I didn't, because if I had thought it over too much or put too much forethought into it, it probably would have turned out differently, and maybe I wouldn't have even made it at all, because I would have gotten scared.
That's fascinating, because it is such a deliberate piece of work. It seems to me to be calculated. The pacing is so deliberate, and there are scenes in this that have haunted me and stayed with me ever since I saw it over a week ago now. There's one scene in particular that I'm fascinated by. It's the scene where Rooney Mara breaks down in grief and she eats a pie, and it's in one shot, and it's extraordinary. How long can you talk about the conception of that shot, where it came from, and holding your nerve as a director?
It is probably my favorite thing I've ever made, is that scene. And it came about because I knew that, you know, this movie was going to be monopolized by the ghost.
Yeah.
That was going to be, he was going to just kind of, you know, it was going to be hard for anything to hold the screen with him, because he was going to be such a dominant shape in the frame. Mm. And I knew that Rooney's character needed to carry the emotional side of the film during the part of the movie she's in. And I needed something that could, you know, distract us from the ghost so that we could pay attention to her for a little bit.
Yeah.
And I also knew that the structure of the movie was such that I wasn't going to have a lot of scenes to play with to convey what she was going through. I would have a very few, and I was designing the movie in such a way that those scenes would be comprised of one or two shots at the most.
Okay.
I really wanted this movie to be comprised entirely of tableaus. And obviously we kind of changed the rules as we went along. It wound up not being a series of tableaus, but nonetheless, that was the idea going into it. And so I just was thinking to myself, what would be the best way to convey her emotion in a single shot that would kind of define what she's going through for an audience?
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, was thinking about unusual displays of grief. And I'd been reading about grief and bereavement. I had just read Joan Didion's book, The Year of Magical Thinking. And okay. I'd been reading other essays and writing about loss and about how it's the little moments by yourself that sneak up and surprise you. It's not when you're looking at a photograph of your loved one that's gone, or the more predictable, or one might say cinematic moments that ultimately are the ones that you feel the most lost during, but all the little moments the in-between moments, those are the ones that sort of sneak up and surprise you. And so I just set upon the idea that she would be eating, and that would be a way of showing grief. And that's something that I've seen in other movies before. Most notably for me, I think Chungking Express,
okay,
the Wong Kar-wai movie, there's a scene where he orders room service because he's heartbroken and just eats like five club sandwiches. And it's completely a different style. He like eats five club sandwiches and then goes running for like 5 miles or something like that. And I just love that. I love the idea of expressing grief through something very physical like that.
Yeah.
And because it is such a physical act. And the act of consumption itself is almost like, you know, a symbol for what she's going through. And so I wrote it into the script. Mm-hmm. And I think Rooney raised a red flag from the very beginning when she read that, because as she told me, she had never eaten pie in her life before and felt very nervous about it. Maybe. I don't know if I believe her that she's never had pie. It's hard for me to believe that.
I don't know. There's obviously certain, you know, diet that actresses have to adhere to in
Hollywood.
True,
but I feel like, you know, with the family that she grew up with, like Thanksgiving must have been a big affair, and surely she would have had like a slice of pie at some point. But I'm gonna accept that she's never had pie before.
Okay.
And she was like asking if we could use different foods or something that she was more comfortable eating, and I kind of wavered a little bit, but then decided, no, there's something about pie that is just, well, A, I love eating it myself. So,
yes.
But I really wanted that to be the thing that she ate. And
what sort of pie was it?
It was a chocolate pie, but she is, you know, gluten-free, vegan. Mm-hmm. I'm vegan as well, so that was an easy part. And we put very little sugar in it.
Okay.
It was custom made. I ate some of we had several made, and I ate one of them myself, and it was delicious. But she hated it. I mean, that's her right. It probably helped the performance, but the simplicity of it was the key. You know, I didn't want it to be a complicated thing. It was meant to last a certain while. Like I knew it was going to be a shot that we had to live in for a while. So we had to make sure the composition of it was good and it would hold up. And so finding the right angle was, you know, important. But once we found it, we really, you know, we left it up to her. I just, you know, she understood what the intent of the scene was. She understood the emotional intent of it. And so we just started rolling. And
amazing.
And I told her, just, you know, eat as much as you can. Try to eat the whole thing. And when you can't eat anymore, that'll be the end of the scene.
And then run to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I mean, one interesting technical note on that is that the ghost wasn't in the shot when we shot it with her. We shot him separately so that we could, you know, play around with his presence. And we shot him coming in and then walking out, and also just standing there in case we wanted to change how he occupied the frame. And, And so as soon as she was done, we filmed the ghost half of it, and then we just composited the two together in post-production.
Amazing. I have to say, it did go through my head. It was like, what if Casey, because I'm assuming it is Casey under the sheet for 90%, 100% of the time. What if he sneezed at this moment? What if he something happened to him during this moment? And I assume this is pretty much a one-and-done situation.
Yeah, there was we knew it would be one take, and we wouldn't get another. That was part of the reason. Another is that we shot the ghost at a different frame rate than for most of the movie. We shot him at a different frame rate than the humans.
Yeah.
And then also, just so we'd have that flexibility in post, I was like, in case I wanted him to enter the frame or to leave, I didn't want to have to like risk, as you say, screwing it up, because it's such an important moment for her. So it was much easier to shoot him separately and then just composite him in. And I mean, it's a very simple split screen. We're able to do it lickety split, but you know, it is, I mean, it's so simple. It's so emotionally sincere and true. And it's one of those moments where I just, you know, it's my favorite thing I've ever made in any of my films. And it's, the whole scene is two shots. Running time total of those two shots is just a little bit over 9 minutes. And the first shot was very well rehearsed and orchestrated, and we had every beat of it planned out. And then the second one was just up to her. And there's,
wow.
And the cumulative effect of the two of them is a scene that is perhaps a make it or break it moment for many audience members, but for mm-hmm. me, it's a scene that you can go into and get lost in and meditate on, and I never get tired of watching.
It's a short film in itself.
It is, yeah, almost. It really is.
It's incredible. And it's an interesting thing. I mean, I asked you at the beginning of the question about holding your nerve as a director, and you know the desire, and a lot of directors must have been to cut away and to cut into the shot and to shoot something else and to shoot different coverage. But also you are asking a lot of the audience. And so how do you know as a director when to hold back and when to push it?
It's a lot of gut instinct, which is kind of how I operate in general on everything. You just follow what feels right. And at the end of the day, it's what feels right to you as an audience member. Like mm-hmm. I'm watching every movie that I make as if I were an audience member, and I'm trying to make sure I'm happy and consistently engaged and never calling BS on anything. And so that's the standard I hold myself to, is just as a fan of movies, as a moviegoer, would this satisfy me? Would this please me? Would this engage me or provoke me? Mm-hmm. And I, beyond that, I just kind of go through it intuitively. And for me, I love holding on something like that. So I have zero instinct to cut in for a close-up on a scene like that, or to get coverage on a scene like that. Mm. But then there are other scenes, like there's a sequence of Casey and Rooney arguing that is scattered throughout the movie. We shot that all as one big scene. And my initial thought with that scene was that it would be a big, wide, stately tableau. And we shot 12 takes of that. Mm-hmm. And it's a 10-minute conversation. And then I just really wanted to get close up. So we kept moving the camera closer and closer, and that scene ended with the moment where Rooney's listening to the song with the headphones on, and that needed to be a 50mm lens right in her face.
Yes.
And so again, I was just operating on instinct. I was like, something, you know, part of it is just Rooney. When you have a camera and Rooney Mara in the same room, you want to just get that camera as close to her as you can. But yeah, you just sort of do what feels right. And, you know, I shot list things sometimes, but, I never stick to them, because when you're in the moment on the set, you know, the movie sort of is speaking to you. Mm-hmm. And as long as it feels true and feels right, you know, you're in the right zone, and you always know when something doesn't feel right. Mm-hmm. And being able to recognize that is tricky. And sometimes it causes a lot of problems, because you don't have a solution. But it's important to be able to just know that, you know, something's not right, something's inaccurate, something's untruthful, and you need to stop and figure out how to fix that.
So a lot of this movie seems to have been driven on instinct as well. Is that fair to say? I mean, just the general approach to the movie.
It is. I mean, it was all written. And if you were to read the screenplay, all 34 pages of it, it would be remarkably close to the finished film. But at the same time, the process of making it and editing it and pushing it through to the final stages was very instinctive. So in the script, you know, the scene where she eats the pie was in there, and it was, you know, it mentioned very literally, like, she sits down and eats the entire pie and then gets up and runs to the restroom. And that's all it said. And so we knew, you know, we're going to shoot that scene, but then in terms of how we shot it and where the camera went and where the cut was from the time that she sat down or standing up to sitting down, and even the fact that she sits down, that was all figured out in the moment, and just sort of like, you know, again, you know, making the decisions based on what felt right and what felt true.
You know, the fact that you were making this as you were making Pete's Dragon, effectively, I mean, yeah, it's obviously not unheard of. I mean, Spielberg made Jurassic Park and Schindler's List in the same year, which
yeah,
is
amazing.
Still boggles my mind.
The conversation in The Godfather 2, like, how do you make both of those movies in one year? Like, that one really freaks me out.
Precisely. Godfather conversation, Godfather 2. I mean, that is just, that's crazy. That's a crazy run. But it's obviously not unheard of. But it's obviously tempting to look at the fact that this is a much smaller movie, and you were going from a bigger movie with Disney and Pete's Dragon. So a ghost story is not a reaction necessarily to the experience you were having shooting a big movie.
No, I mean, it's very easy to look at it with the one for me, one for them mentality.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's reductive to both films, I feel. Although I understand it. Like, on the surface, it makes sense. But it was more just, you know, I felt I had the idea for a ghost story, and it felt like something I had the capacity to make. And I had the timing was right, and I had a window of free time in which I could either take a vacation or make a movie. And I decided to make a movie. And
that's amazing.
And I like both films equally. I mean, they are both just as personal to me as, you know, anything else I've ever made, if not more so. I mean, Pete's Dragon, in spite of, you know, I didn't have Final Cut on it. It was a movie that was made for the widest possible audience. Mm-hmm. And yet I was able to make something that felt very true to me and very personal. Yeah. And I love that movie, and I'm very proud of it. And the ghost story is the same way. Like, that movie is no less or more a personal work than anything else. And they fit together to me in a strange way, even though they're very different and obviously made for different audiences. But there's a common theme or common ground the two have, and I suppose the common ground is just me, because I made them and they mean something to me. So that's probably what it is.
David, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much, Nate.
Thank you so much.
Thank
really
you.
Great.
Sorry for almost dying.
It just added something special to the whole thing.
Okay, we're going to start this week's review section with a ghost story. A film, Phil, I'll be honest, that has stayed with me since I saw it, and my initial reaction to Ghost Story is not the reaction I have to it now. But
you described it as utter shit.
I did. I wanted to burn the negative.
No, of course it didn't.
No, you didn't. You didn't.
Just a bit of fun.
You know what? We did have that conversation when we came out of the screening.
Yeah.
Where we're like, that's a film. You like to leave it a night before you start to review a film, at least I do, and see how you feel about it the next day.
I like to review it while I'm watching it.
Yeah. In this case, it is a film that grows on you. Now, look, someone's given it 3 stars. That person, as it turns out, I'm reading the mag, and it seems to be me. I've given the film 3 stars.
That's a recommendation. That's fine. As we always say in the podcast, 3 stars is a recommendation.
Yeah, but it seems to be a film that people either really, really love, mostly,
yeah,
or really don't like and didn't get at all.
Yes.
I have perversely gone for somewhere in the middle. I just felt like, okay, first, just to set it up very briefly, Casey Affleck plays a character called C. Rooney Mara plays his wife, M. Mm-hmm. C dies. M survives. C picks himself up off the slab, covered in a basically a sheet, mm-hmm. like a Scooby-Doo villain, and returns slowly home across fields into his house, and then just stays there, effectively. And time passes in a kind of a Dunkirkian, interstellary sort of way, you know, thing you're never quite sure. Yeah, it accelerates and it slows down and you see things happening, and he plays silent witness to, first of all, his wife's grief, then her moving on, and then life moving on, and then the planet moving on, and then everything kind of
Well,
surprising you.
Yeah.
I don't want to give too much away in terms of how it all plays out. But it is glacially slow at times. Yeah. Not always, but at times. It doesn't explain anything, and it doesn't have any interest in showing you car crashes or showing you whiz-bang, wallop, narrative-y things.
Or anything of real...
Yeah. If you want something to grip hold of, this film is very much all kind of like smooth surfaces, and it's hard sometimes to get traction on it. But if you approach it as a beautiful piece of art, and it did remind me of, you know, sometimes you go to an art gallery and you watch an art installation unfolding, and it felt like that almost more than it felt like a feature film at times. But I think David Lowery, you know, he's got to be congratulated for coming up with something that just on paper sounds absolutely nuts, and it does work. You know, we've given it 3 stars. I think a lot of people love it a lot more than that. A lot of people really, really moved by it, and I think that there are times in your life when this film will probably break you, because it does have real soul. Mm-hmm. But it won't be to everyone's taste.
No, that's for sure.
It really won't. And I would just say, you know, think about, you know, have a think about kind of the sort of experience you want from going to the cinema before you tackle this one. There'll be people that will love it, and there'll be other people who'll find it very, very frustrating. I glibly described it as being like Terrence Malick's Rent-A-Ghost, which is very glib.
Which but it's not untrue.
But did you feel that? Yeah.
David Lowery in the interview described it as Beetlejuice as directed by Apichat Thong. We're aesthetical.
He's is better, obviously. Yeah. Okay. And he didn't like, I mean, there's an amazing story because he didn't tell anyone he was making it.
No.
You know, he was so kind of wary and worried about it that he just didn't tell anyone that it was happening. So it wasn't really on our radar until quite soon before it appeared on the sort of festival circuit. But people have really warmed to it. Nicola Richards, who follows me on Twitter, we've been chatting, and she told me how much it moved her, affected her. I didn't get quite the same sort of gut punch response to it emotionally, but there's certainly lots of food for thought in this movie.
I think you're right. There's probably times in my life I might like it more than I did. I'm currently kind of in the negative camp on it. I can appreciate it, but I didn't in any way connect with it.
Maybe not everyone's supposed to connect with this film all the time.
Maybe.
I don't know that I connected with it. I'll be honest, when I saw it for the first time, it's a really challenging watch. It's very slow, as Phil said. It's very glacially paced. The compositions are very, very careful. There is a scene, as we talked about, I think, I don't know whether it was included because the interview with David Lowery is quite long, so I don't know how much was cut out. But if, in case you didn't hear it, there is a scene in which Rooney Mara post death of her husband.
Yeah.
That's not a spoiler. Goes in to her house and picks up a pie, a chocolate pie that is sitting on the counter, and eats it in one take that lasts, I'm guessing,
like
5-6 minutes. It's one shot, one take, and it's on that level, it's a really challenging sit. And there are moments you're thinking, okay, this is a director maybe trying to push it as far as he possibly can.
Apparently she'd never had pie before. Which is just weird in itself.
Well, there you go.
Anyway.
But so there are moments in this film that will test your patience and it will test you to the limit. But I'll be honest, it is a film that I've rarely been able to get out of my head since I saw it. And this is months ago. I think we saw it. When did we see it? May?
It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a
David
while.
Lowery was in for Sundance. We saw it just before he came over. And I think it was either the end of April or the beginning of May. And we all saw it then. And I've been thinking about the visuals. I've been thinking about the resonance of it. It's a film that has big, weighty ideas in its head about eternity and guilt and grief. And it's very, very difficult to stop thinking about. And I can feel the movie dancing slowly, imperceptibly towards even my top 10 of the year list, which is so weird given where I was when I came out of the cinema, which was, I appreciate what David Lowery is trying to do as a director. I think he's very unusual in American cinema right now. He has, you know, there's a real sort of artistry to what he's doing. He operates entirely at his own pace. But this one has stayed with me in a way that I did not expect. Mm. But hey,
it does. This film does plant a seed.
It does.
No question. And it does do things differently from other films, which is great. Mm. But I stand by the fact that I just don't think that everyone will love this. And
God, people will go and see this, and there will be some people who will be. There are people who will go and see this and they'll be bored out of their skulls. There will be people who see this and they will actively hate the film and they'll come out wanting to burn down the podcast for recommending it. But there'll also be people who would go and I think will connect with it. And I don't know whether they will connect emotionally with it, because weirdly enough, I didn't necessarily connect emotionally with it, because you don't get to know the characters enough, I would say, for that to happen. But I think you get to connect intellectually with it on some level, and you maybe also get to connect with it, weirdly enough, spiritually with it on a different level as well. It does ask big questions about, you know, life and what happens after life and all that sort of stuff. And you can see as well little moments, grace notes of humor, little grace notes of what it could have been had he gone down the horror route as well. There's a pretty big jump scare in this movie that got me, I have to say.
I'd love it if someone recut the trailer as a horror movie.
You could.
In the sort of Mary Poppins style.
But also, I always talk in this podcast about how I admired when directors bring us something we haven't seen before and they really swing for the fences. And this movie has a newly minted Oscar winner, albeit he hadn't won the Oscar at that time, standing under a sheet for pretty much the entire movie, not speaking, barely moving. And I haven't seen that before. And I applaud it.
Well, I can't applaud it because I gave it three. Although,
you can applaud it. That's a recommendation. Yeah, that's fine.
It is a recommendation.
It's fine. I'd go four. I'd go, but it's creeping up all the time. It's creeping up all the time. Helen, I think, I'm guessing you're five. You're a five or a six. You're in that camp.
Yeah, right.
So
we'll see where you are for the end of year review.
It might be on your top.
It could be. I mean, yeah.
you seem pretty resistant to its
charms. I'm a little bit resistant.
Anything can happen, though.
Is it closer to your top 10 than our next film, which is Annabelle Creation?
It is closer to my top 10 than Annabelle Creation.
All right,
yeah.
Okay. So tell us about Annabelle Creation.
Annabelle Creation is a prequel to the spin-off of The Conjuring.
It's a prequel to the prequel to the prequel of Conjuring 2.
It's a prequel to the prequel to the prequel to the prequel of Conjuring 2, I think, yeah. I'm very confused. Anyway, so there was The Conjuring, and then it had a spin-off called Annabelle, which was set before it.
That's right.
This is set before that.
And then there's been
The Conjuring 2, which came after The Conjuring.
Correct.
But there's also a Scary Nun movie coming up, and there's a little nod to that here as well. So it's quite subtle. Basically, there's a Conjuring extended universe.
They are literally calling it The Conjuring Universe.
Yeah, and this is the latest installment, and it is scary. For my money, it wasn't quite as scary as the Conjuring movies, but it was more scary than Annabelle.
Yes.
And this is set in the sort of 30s, 40s initially.
Yeah.
A husband and wife, an improbably prosperous doll maker who makes like horrible looking dolls, but somehow has a really nice house.
Someone has to buy these horrible looking dolls, right?
I mean, apparently people are gagging for them.
My sister had loads growing up.
Well, okay, so your sister was holding out for these scary-looking dolls, which were made by Anthony LaPaglia and his wife Miranda Otto, and then tragedy strikes their family. Then 12 years later, they decide to open their house to small, vulnerable children from the local orphanage.
In hindsight, accompanied
by a lovely nun, just to make it clear that not all nuns are scary and evil.
No.
There is also lovely nuns.
Yes.
So this lovely nun and her small, vulnerable female charges.
My lovely, lovely, lovely nun.
That's not quite it, but okay. Close. Yeah. They all come to live in this house where the parents are clearly traumatized by what happened to their own daughter 12 years before, and nothing bad is going to happen.
That's
okay.
Especially because the parents is so traumatized that she now lives in a darkened room and won't come out ever.
And wears a doll mask.
There's a room that they're told not to go into in this dark, cavernous house.
Which is also a super good start. Super good.
With we should mention as well that one of the leads in this movie is crippled, and she has polio, I think?
She's suffering polio, and she's been left with a very severe limp and has to wear a sort of brace on her leg to be able to walk at all. And to get upstairs, obviously, that presents some problems, so she has a scary stair lift. A stair lift. What would be scary about it? That's weird. I didn't mean to say that. Anyway,
there's no way that's going to malfunction at a crucial moment.
Definitely not. That was Talitha Bateman, by the way. No relation to Jason, apparently. The child performances were all good. The scares were very much present and correct. Uh-huh. It was gross at times, like really horrible.
What do you think?
Yeah, no, just in terms of like Bad things. The doll is very upsetting. I don't understand why anyone would have bought that doll in the first place. Like, that is a nasty looking doll at the best of times. Even when before it starts like turning its head and looking at you for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's very much in the vein of those films. So it's less about overall numbers of deaths and more about just creeping horror the whole way through. I find it quite scary. But somehow, there was something about the rhythm of the scares was a little bit off to me sometimes. And that's why I wouldn't go higher than The Conjuring or anything. It's like something just about characters were whimpering when they should scream or screaming when they should whimper. There was something about the build-up of some of the scares. It just, the rhythm and the music of the scare felt a little bit...
It's an interesting film in that it has a lot of characters. I think it has too many characters.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Too many characters for one thing. And it tends to imperil one character or a group of characters and stay with them for quite a long time and then leave the other plot threads dangling.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a little bit off at times. I think the last 20-30 minutes descends into loud noises, Phil, a little bit. I thought there's some really interesting batshit crazy ideas with things moving around they shouldn't be moving around and whatnot in the last half hour or so. That I thought was really interesting. I'll be honest, this is a film I quite enjoyed. I went into it thinking it was going to be another blasé jump scare film spin-off. But I quite liked it, weirdly enough. I didn't enjoy the last film by the director David F. Sandberg, who directed a film called Lights Out, which came out, I think, last year with Teresa Palmer. Had a nice, decent concept and some decent scenes, but by and large... blew itself out before you even had a chance to get into it. And this is a much more languid film. It's about 20 minutes in before we even get anything close to a scare. You actually, as a director who allows himself an opportunity to get to know the characters and to get to know the location of the scary house in which all the bad things are going to happen. And that's very, very important because he shows you things that, you know, he shows you the scare lift and you're going, okay, well, that's going to come into play later on, surely. And he shows you there's a deep, dark, scary well. Well, I'm sure that won't come into play later in the film either. And I quite enjoyed that. I quite enjoyed the sort of the panache of the setup. And I don't think it always quite delivers on the setup.
Yeah.
Again, too many characters. I don't think enough is given to Anthony DePaglia and to Miranda Otto to do.
And I don't know that we needed another scary dumb waiter. I feel
what
like,
was he doing there?
Hey.
It's completely the wrong film.
I feel like we get a lot of those and I felt like I didn't need it this time.
Yeah, I guess.
But a lot of the rest of the stuff was quite effective.
Yeah, it really gave me optimism for the rest of the Conjuring cinematic universe or whatever they're calling it. I like both the Conjuring films. Didn't like Annabelle so much. But I like the fact that we won't give anything away, but there are things that happen in this movie that surprised me and twists and turns that I didn't see coming. And so fingers crossed. That the future films, Conjuring 3 and The Nun and The Crooked Man and all these movies that they're planning to do will be equally good.
So that was...
3 stars.
3 stars, which is a recommendation.
By me.
Oh, hey.
By Chris Hewitt. Who's got 2 stars and... Who's got 2 stars and 3 thumbs? This guy.
Wait, what?
I don't know. So there you go. 3 stars then for Annabelle Creation. And then last but not least, we have Charlize Theron kicking bottom as Brit spy the rain kick a lot in what's her last name?
Broughton.
Lorraine Broughton in the spy thriller Atomic Blonde, which I may be going to see tonight with my drinking game buddy, my wife.
Ah,
she really wants to see it.
It's very cool.
It is very cool,
literally and figuratively, because it's winter.
It is winter. Winter has come in Berlin, 1989. Can I ask you a question before we get into the review?
Sure.
Did you understand any of it?
I'll be honest, I think there's at least like 40% too much plot. Now, I realise that that's sort of a common failing for spy movies when you have to make some allowances, but there is a lot of plot happening, especially actually in the last half hour where things should be getting really, really streamlined. And suddenly all this plot comes at you and you're like, ah, punch somebody quick. That said, it's a lot of fun. Charlize Theron is just at her absolute coolest, like you've never seen her. Like, sort of picture...
She was cool, a monster.
Picture Imperator Furiosa, right? Uh-huh. Crossed with her, like, model persona from the Dior ads, right? That's kind of what we're talking about here. So she could absolutely kill you, but she still looks more amazing than any human being you've ever seen in your life. It's sort of, it's in that realm, right? And so she's sent to Berlin because somebody has stolen a list of double agents.
Okay, and this is good so far. I missed all of this. No, okay, I'm kidding. I got that.
I mean, that's basically Skyfall, right?
Mission Impossible as well.
Yeah, it's been going on a
list.
Lot.
It's a knock list.
So she has to go and try and get this list back, but it doesn't really matter. She has the spectacularly dodgy, like obviously untrustworthy James McAvoy is David Percival, who's the station chief. He's supposed to help her. He's totally not going to. And she has various sort of foreign agents to contend with. There's obviously KGB, there's Stasi, and there is Sofia Boutella as a French agent in it for some reason as well. And that'll become clear. So, there's a lot going on plot-wise. And it doesn't really matter. You shouldn't really go looking for plot. You should go looking for incredible fight scenes. This is obviously directed by David Leitch, who's the other guy who did John Wick. Uh-huh. He didn't do John Wick 2. He went off and did this instead.
Yes.
But he has brought the same commitment to just kicking ass with him and really impressively so. And I think what's really good about this as well is that a lot of the time when there are women fighting lots of men in movies like this, people go, oh, it's impossible. It's not realistic that she could beat them. It's Charlize Theron, so you kind of buy it. But B, she generally doesn't beat them with brute strength. She generally uses tools better than they do. And that sort of is what allows her to win in fights. Spoiler, she does win some of the fights. So it sort of deals with that objection, I think, quite well in the fights.
Yeah.
They are astonishing, and the action sequencing is really impressive. And you just kind of wish there was a bit more action and a bit less plotting because the plotting is not as good. But this is super Bondian. It's super Bondy, though. Like, it's like there's scenes in this that could have come straight from Casino Royale in particular, I thought. There's little bits of Nikita, obviously, and there's that sort of French cinema du luxe, thing going on, definitely. But there's also like a real Bondy sort of feel to this, except that she is cooler than Bond ever has been. She even has a discussion about a watch at one point, for God's sake.
Yeah. Can I ask a question? I haven't seen it. It's a great rock and roll cinema city.
Yeah.
Does it look good?
It does look very good, although apparently German critics...
Is it a character in the movie?
Apparently German critics were annoyed that this was A, largely shot in Budapest, I believe, and B, they don't feel it accurately represents Berlin in 89. So apparently they were not happy with it. But as someone who's just seen Wings of Desire and thought that looked amazing, it's got that sort of a feel to it. So yeah, I was very on board with how it looked and not massively so on board with its plot.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same. I wonder if I'm going to have the same reaction to this movie that I had with John Wick, where I saw John Wick the first time.
Sure.
And it left me a little cold. I wonder if John Wick is basically my ghost story, but of action
Maybe
movies.
I'll
or
love
if ghost
story.
Story is John Wick of existential crisis movies, who knows? And I watched it for the first time, and I could see it was cool, and I could see all the action sequences were well done, and yeah, there was a cute dog and all that sort of stuff. It was fine. It kind of washed over me, and I came out going, it's all right. And then I watched it a second time, and that was when it got me. And I wonder if Atomic Blonde, which is a film I enjoyed a lot, and I thought it was very, very good, and the action sequences, including one particular extended fight sequence with Charlize versus unstoppable killing machine dude type thing, is just amazing. I mean, like, raid level amazing. Loads of action sequences are great, and I really enjoyed it, but it left me cold, and the plot baffled me and hurt my brain. You say it's very Bondian. I didn't really get that at all. I think this is a cooler film than any Bond film has ever been.
Oh, that's
true. But it's deliberately cool, and I think maybe sometimes a little bit too self-consciously cool and a little overreaching in terms of its coolness at times.
Sometimes its music is very on the nose.
Like Zemeckis-y on the nose.
It is.
But I really liked Charlize. I thought she was fantastic. I thought James McAvoy was very, very good as you know, Colonel Straight and Narrow, whatever his name is. And great action sequences. Good soundtrack.
By the way, we're not giving anything away here.
No, we're not.
That is 100% in the trailer.
Yeah. It's not even in the trailer. It's the first time you see this guy. It's basically like he's doing something really shifty.
Yeah.
But the question is he actively working against her or with her?
Is he shifty in a good way or shifty in a bad way?
And is she shifty at all? Or is anyone shifty? Can anyone be trusted? And you know who can be trusted? Eddie Marsan. who has an excellent moustache in this film, for a while at least. And he could be trusted. Action sequences are good. But I just wonder if the second time I see it, whether it's going to really, you know, really get me to the point where I love John Wick now. And I think John Wick 2 is one of the best films of the year.
It could be. And I'll be honest, I gave this 3 stars, but is a very high 3. And I did flirt for a long time with a 4.
Yeah.
And I went back and forth between the two. And I decided if I gave it 4, I'd have to spend a while explaining why you might not agree with me.
Yeah.
Whereas if I gave it 3, there's no way you can argue with that.
But I think if you like John Wick, you'll like this movie.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Cool.
Cool.
I think this is a week of 3 stars that could easily go up depending on your mood and the time of watching.
Yeah.
Annabelle Creation is a, you know, it is a studio horror film that has all the drawbacks of a studio horror film, but if it gets you in the right mood, you will jump and scream and shriek in all the right places and you will come out thinking that was a great time. A ghost story may get you in the feels, it may get you in the thinks, but sooner or later, it's going to get you. And Atomic Blonde, I think, is a superior action movie, and I cannot wait to see what David Leitch does with Deadpool 2. So, fingers crossed. So, you know what, if you're feeling in a good mood, give everything an extra star this week. Go on. That's courtesy of Uncle Chris. And that's it for this week's Emperor Podcast, brought to you by Sky Atlantic. Be sure, of course, to watch out for their epic new TV drama, Tin Star, with Tim Roth and Christina Hendricks. And as I mentioned before, all 10 episodes will be available to binge watch at your pleasure from the 7th of September, only, of course, on Sky Atlantic, and also weekly, every Monday, on Sky Atlantic as well. It is not to be missed. And join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by the one and only Stanley Tucci. Oh, yes. The Tooch himself will be here to talk about his new film, Final Portrait. Phil, I'm going to be tooching myself in excitement. All right, what about you? You going to tooch yourself?
There's
no right answer to that question. No. I'm going to interview him.
You're not going
to...
Okay. Well, that's what I meant.
It's a different thing, Chris.
Okay. Until a momentous occasion, it is goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Helen.
Phil's still frowning at that joke. Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to watch Arseholes at Night. I've just Googled it. It looks very interesting. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye.
No.